Last Lord's Day morning, we looked at the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and that passage and theme is still on my mind this morning. I didn't get as far as I wanted to last time, so I would like to return to Genesis chapter 1, and we'll begin by reading this morning in the 25th verse, Genesis 1, I should have said verse 26, Genesis 1, 26. And God said, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them, and God blessed them. And God said unto them, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." This section in the first 11 chapters of the Bible, as we stated last time, covers about 40% of human history. 1,500 years elapses from Genesis 1:1 until the end of Genesis chapter 11. And this passage is the foundation, the basis for everything else that follows. These chapters lay out, in other words, the nuts and bolts of the biblical world view. Now, you might say, Brother Goins, what is a world view? And if you were to look in the dictionary, it doesn't help very much, because if you look up the word world view in Funk and Wagnalls or Merriam-Webster, it will say a view of the world. That's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it? A world view, though, is an overarching, big-picture narrative by which we interpret everything else in terms of that big picture. It's a framework through which you and I make sense of the world around us. You may say, Brother Goins, I don't have a world view, and I beg to differ. Everybody, whether they can articulate it or not, has a view or a way of thinking about life and the world, about the meaning of life and the purpose of life. Even the person who says that life has no purpose, that in its own right is a worldview. It's a philosophy about the meaning of life and of our place and significance in human history. Someone else might say, "What difference does it make, Brother Goins? How I think about the world, what difference does it make whether or not I have a biblical worldview?" And the answer is because ideas have consequences. By way of illustration of that principle, what would happen if a surgeon had ideas about human anatomy that were not accurate? What if he thought that the gallbladder was the heart muscle? And he went in to do a gallbladder removal and he ended up removing your heart. That idea, that false idea, has extreme consequences, does it not? And a human being's ideas about what it means to be human and what the meaning of life is ultimately matters, because it determines how we approach every day that we live. It determines how we interact with other people. You've heard it said, perhaps, that people are just animals, that man just happens to be at the top of the food chain right now, but he's really no different than other animals. That's an idea. But if that's true, my friends, then it shouldn't surprise us when people believe that if they act like animals. You see, ideas have consequences. Now, there are different types of worldviews. There's the atheist worldview that says there is no God. And of course, that idea is going to have dramatic consequence in the way that the atheist approaches life. The atheist says there's no God. The humanist says man is his own God. You are the master of your fate and the captain of your own soul. That you chart your course and you answer to nobody but yourself. That's the humanist worldview. The atheist says there's no God. The humanist says that man is his own God. The secularist says that matter, the material world, is God. That we live just to be productive. And the Eastern mystic says that everything is God. All is God. God is all, and all is God. But what is important, my friends, is that we have, as Christian people, a biblical, not an atheistic or a humanistic or a mystical worldview, but that we have a biblical worldview. The George Barna Research Group in 2017 did a survey, and they concluded that only 9% of professing Christian people have a biblical worldview. Now, that's pretty sad. Only 9%. And they surveyed them with these questions. Does absolute moral truth exist? Is that absolute truth defined by the Bible alone? Is God the creator and an all-powerful and all-knowing maker of the universe? And does he still rule that universe today? Is the Bible accurate in everything that it teaches? The question was asked, is the devil real? Did Jesus Christ actually live a sinless life? And is salvation a divine gift that cannot be earned? Only 9% of professing Christians responded affirmatively to each of these questions. That's a pretty sad indictment on the condition of a biblical worldview among professing Christian people today. And that's why Genesis chapters 1 through 11 are so basic and fundamental and important to us, because we can't develop a biblical worldview without the great truths that are revealed here at the beginning of the biblical record. These chapters identify each of the big ideas that comprise the biblical worldview, and you could probably summarize those ideas in terms of several C words. Creation, that's part of the biblical worldview. The curse and the corruption that ensued in human beings as a result of the fall of sin. Creation, the curse, catastrophe. Genesis chapters 6 through 9 describe the global flood, the deluge, when God judged the earth and cleansed it. So you've got creation, the curse, the catastrophe of the flood, the confusion that followed even after the flood at the Tower of Babel, when God came down and confused or confounded the languages so that man could not unite in a revolt against the government of heaven. And then Christ and the cross, and that theme is also developed in the first 11 chapters of the Bible. So you see, in these chapters, we have each of these major movements or developments in the big picture of human history: creation, corruption, catastrophe, confusion, Christ and the cross. And, of course, the biblical story ends with the consummation of all things in the new heavens and the new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. So what I want to do this morning, though, as we look at these chapters in more detail than we did last week, is to approach this great theme of the importance of a biblical worldview in terms of three big categories. Let's talk about theology, that's the doctrine of God; anthropology, that's the doctrine of man; and soteriology, that's the doctrine of salvation. And all of those great truths are in these three chapters. First of all, the first 11 chapters of Genesis teach us some very important basic truths about God. Number one, we learn that God is eternal, and you see that in the very first verse of the Bible, in the beginning, God. Now notice it doesn't say in the beginning of God. In the beginning, God is already there. And you say, where did God come from? And the answer is that God is eternal. And to say that God is eternal means that he has no beginning and no ending. that God has always been and he will always be. His name is the great what? I am. Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. I'm glad this morning to be able to worship a God, to proclaim a God who is the origin of all that exists. He's the creator. He's eternal. Psalm 90, verse 1 in the prayer of Moses reads as follows, "From everlasting to everlasting, thou art God." That word everlasting is interesting in Psalm 90, verse 1. It is a picture word and it means the vanishing point. Have you ever seen a mirage on the highway as you were driving on a warm summer day? Looked like a pool of water in front of you. But as you got closer to that pool of water, it what? It dissipated, it vanished. You reached a vanishing point. The horizon is a vanishing point. It is the limit of my vision. I can see no further than the horizon. Now, of course, there have been people, I'm told, that believed that the horizon was the end of the world, that it ceased to exist, but it's just the point in which my perception vanishes. And when he says, from the vanishing point this way, as far backward as I can see this way, and as far forward as I can see this way, from the vanishing point here, from everlasting to everlasting, God is the same. He's still there. Thou art God. Now, the first chapter of the Bible and the first verse teaches us about a God who didn't have a beginning. And that means he didn't have to grow up like you or I had to grow up. It means he doesn't have a birth date. He doesn't have an origin. He didn't derive from another source. The God that we worship today is the only eternal being in this universe. Nothing else is eternal. Now, of course, the Darwinist says that rocks are eternal. They believe matter is eternal. If you were to ask the typical science professor on a university campus, I say the typical, there are some exceptions, but if you were to ask the typical science professor today, what is the origin of the universe, they would say there was a particle floating in space, hurtling itself randomly in space, and that there was another particle, and these two particles collided. And somehow there was the generation of electricity, whether it was an external lightning bolt or through the friction of their collision, there was a great explosion, a big bang. And everything that we see around us today came about as a result of this Big Bang. So what is that theory really saying? It's saying that a rock or a particle of dust is eternal, right? And it's saying that all life came from non-life. That everything that exists, human beings, animals, plant life, that it all came from a rock. And I challenge any scientist to duplicate that theory in a laboratory. You can't do it. Life does not come from non-life. That's the most basic law of biology. Biogenesis is the idea that life begets life, and that inanimate matter begets nothing. But something in the universe has to be eternal. Here's my point. There has to be something that is eternal. It's either an eternal God with a wise, intelligent, all-wise mind that made everything that exists, or it is an inanimate rock that somehow self-generated, self-created, that somehow spontaneously became the complex structure that we see around us, both on a macro and a micro level. And my beloved, may I say, here's the basis of a biblical worldview. The Bible admits that God and God alone is from everlasting to everlasting. The great I am. He's self-existent, self-sustaining. self-governing, self-determining. God needs nothing outside of himself. God alone is like that burning bush, forever expending energy, but not consumed, not diminished. God is eternal. Now, that's the first great theological truth that we glean from the first verse of the Bible. If you were to ask me today, Brother Goins, what is the most important verse in the Bible? I would have to answer, it's not John 3:16, as beloved as that verse is, and it's not Ephesians 2:8 or Romans 8, verses 29 and 30. The most important verse in the Bible is Genesis 1:1. Because, my friends, if you don't start here, then everything else is going to be out of place. And if you do start here and believe this, then everything else is going to make sense. It's not going to surprise you when you read that the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea on dry ground. You say, oh, I just can't believe that. It's not going to surprise you if you understand that God made everything that exists out of nothing. And it's not going to surprise you that a whale swallowed Jonah. And you're not going to be skeptical and say, I've opted for a naturalistic explanation of the universe, when you understand that there's a supernatural God beyond nature who is the source and the origin of all that exists. So God is eternal and God is the creator. And this truth is developed elsewhere in the Bible. For instance, listen now to John chapter 1, verse 3. This chapter begins the same way Genesis 1 begins. In the beginning was the Word. Notice the word's already there. Capital W, and this is a title for the second person in the Trinity named Logos, the Word of God, the Son of God. This Word became flesh and dwelt among us. But in the beginning, the Word was already there. Jesus, in other words, did not begin to exist in Bethlehem's manger. He's the eternal Son of God who has always existed from all eternity past. But he says in John 1:3 that all things were made by him. Notice he created all things that exist. Now he's the only uncreated essence in the universe. Everything else is derived from him. So I look at this podium made of wood today. Somebody made the wood. The wood wouldn't be here unless an eternal creator had created the trees from which we derived the wood. Every atom, every molecule, every chemical reaction in nature, everything that exists, all matter, all time, all space. The universe is not eternal. By the way, that person that says a rock was hurtling through space, I would ask, if the rock is the only thing that's eternal, where did the space come from? And if an electrical charge caused the rock to develop into atoms or molecules and it became something living, then where did the electrical charge come from, you see? You trace an idea back to its logical source, I dare say it's going to lead to insanity unless you understand the biblical worldview. It begins with God. And my friends, if you're going to make sense of the world and of your life, you too and I have to begin with God. He's the eternal God. He's the creator of all things. By him were all things made, and without him was nothing made that was made. Listen to Acts 17. Paul on Mars Hill preaches about God the creator. He says, God, verse 24, Acts 17:24, God that made the world and all things that are therein. Notice that. God made the world and all that is therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth. Here's the biblical worldview. The God who created it all is above it all. He's the Lord of heaven and earth. He dwelleth not in temples made with hands. That is, you can't confine him. He's so infinite, so immense. He's so great. Now, you see, this is why it's important to have a biblical worldview. Because so many people have a distorted view of the greatness of God. They've diminished God to man's level. There's a verse in Psalm 50 where God criticizes the people of his day, saying, thou thoughtest that I was altogether such an one as thyself. And by the way, that's what idolaters have done throughout history. They've tried to bring God down to a level that we can understand. Maybe you're here this morning, you say, Brother Goins, I just don't understand something that's eternal. You may be like one of my children one time when we were talking about the eternality of God, that he's without beginning, without ending. And she said, Daddy, when I try to think about that, my mind just goes blank. I thought, I've never heard it put like that, but that explains the sensation that I feel when I try to think about something that doesn't have a beginning and doesn't have an ending, because every one of us had a beginning and every one of us will have an ending in this world. But God is essentially in his person, in his being, without beginning, without ending, and the source of everything else that exists. So here the Apostle Paul says that God that made the worlds is the Lord of it all, and he doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. We cannot confine this great, majestic, sovereign God to a box or to a structure. He's so much greater than you can imagine, than I can conceive. This is the God of the Bible. J.B. Phillips wrote a book back in the 1960s that made the rounds. Maybe you've seen a copy. I have one in my library, entitled Your God is Too Small, in which he indicts modern man for debasing God and trying to explain him in humanistic terms. May I say, my friends, we need to look at the universe and the world and everything that is in it with this understanding that God is above it all. He's greater than it all. He's greater than his creation. He's greater than your problems. He's greater than your sin. I'm glad I get to preach a great God. And somebody says, Brother Goins, that's one thing I don't like about you Primitive Baptists, is that's all you do is brag on God. Well, I'll tell you, he's worth bragging on. Psalm 44:22 says, we boast in the Lord all the day long. If you're going to brag about somebody, you might as well boast about somebody that deserves it. All day long, you can't ever tell it all, can you? If we were talking about me or you this morning, we would have already closed up shop and gone home, right? Because you say, let's talk about our accomplishments. It's not going to take us long to catalog our achievements. But when we start talking about the great things that God has done and how worthy he is, may I say, my friends, we have reason to stay here all day. That's why old Baptists like to get there early and stay there late. That's why they'll drive 30 miles, 50 miles, 2 hours to church. Somebody says, there's a church right down here on the corner. They say, no, I'm going over yonder, because a great God is proclaimed. That's why we worship, right? I come this morning to hear about God. I come to be reminded of who he is, because I forget that. You see, as I go about the week and I see what's happening in our country and I see the chaos in society at large throughout this world, and I hear about the violence and the crime and the human exploitation, and I hear about the contention and the debates over perceived social injustice and all of these things in society around us, and I have to say, I need to be put back in touch with ultimate reality. And what is ultimate reality? It's this: God that made the world and all that is therein dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything. Are we improving him this morning because we're here to worship him? No. The fact is, the improvement that is received here is we're the beneficiaries of that. We're the ones being improved, but we're not improving God. He's still going to be just as powerful, just as great, just as majestic, just as holy, just as merciful. He's still going to be just as high and lifted up, whether I exalt him or acknowledge that or not today. I'm not going to change him any. This is where it all begins, that in him we live and move and have our being. He's the creator. And how did he create the universe? He did it ex nihilo, or out of nothing. Man can't create a thing. I like what the late Elder C.M. Mills said when someone objected and said, well, man can create a fuss. He said, no, he can't even create a fuss. He has the ingredients for a fuss within himself before he ever has the fuss. You see, he's using something that's already there. But when God created the universe, he created it out of nothing. So that tells us something else about God. Not only is he the eternal creator of all things that exist, but it tells us that he's an all-powerful, an all-wise God, right? What power would it take to create the universe? Verse 3 of chapter 1 of Genesis says, "And God said, let there be light." Now, how did he create is the question I ask you, and the answer is by simply speaking. Yes. He created by divine imperative. Now, the girls in our homeschooling curriculum have been learning the difference between a declarative sentence and an interrogative sentence. Declarative sentence, of course, just states a fact. It declares. An interrogative sentence interrogates, or it asks a question. And an exclamatory sentence exclaims with feeling and emotion. And an imperative sentence issues a command. An imperative sentence would be like this: go clean your room. You see, I'm, as the father, issuing an order. I'm issuing a command. That's an imperative. May I suggest, dear friends, when God said, "Let there be light," that divine command, that divine fiat, brought into existence that which previously did not exist. God created the universe. Here's the power that he exerted by the mere spoken creative voice of his power. You believe God's voice has power? When he speaks, things happen. Somebody says when E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen, you know. I'm telling you, when God speaks, creation occurs. God's voice can bring into existence that which previously did not exist. I love Hebrews chapter 1, verse 2, that it says, he created all things by the word of his power. By that same word, he says, they are held together. They consist. He upholds all things. The God who spoke it all into existence now maintains the universe that he made. That's why I'm not worried about man destroying the universe or the planet. It's going to take a lot more than man is able to do to destroy this planet. In fact, the Bible tells us, you see, here's the importance of a biblical worldview, that while the earth remaineth, this is Genesis 8:22, while the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, night and day shall not cease. 2 Peter chapter 3 teaches that the creation is held in store, and it's reserved in store until the days of judgment, when it will be destroyed by fire. Now, God's going to consume the elements with fervent heat. Every molecule will be dismantled. Every structure in nature will be disassembled. God is going to fold it all up like a vesture. The universe is going to be disassembled by the power of God one day. He made it, and he alone is able to destroy it. And he will one day, but until then, he upholds it all. Have you ever noticed that the planets continue their orbit? You say, well, the Earth is getting, it's a fraction of a millimeter closer to the sun than it was 100 years ago. Well, I understand. I'm sure scientists can measure these positions of the heavenly bodies and say that the magnetism is changing and there's flux and it's not consistent. And I'm worried about the future, but I'm telling you, the Bible assures us that God upholds it all by the word of his power. By him, says Colossians 1:17, that is, by Jesus Christ, all things consist, not only exist, but they consist, meaning they are held together. And this God is all powerful then. Look at Psalm 33, verse 6. This is just one passage I will used to show you that creation speaks of the power of God. I love to think about a God who's not handcuffed, not handicapped. He doesn't have a withered arm. His arm is not short. that it cannot save, nor his, he's not hard of hearing, nor his ear heavy, that it cannot hear. I'm glad to trust a God who's omnipotent. I said, Brother Goins, what does omnipotent mean? All powerful. Omnipotent. God has power. Now, man is impotent, right? Man has no power, but God has all power. He's omnipotent. Psalm 33:6 says it like this: by the word of the Lord were the heavens made. There it is. He spoke and it was done by the word of the Lord. By the way, that's the same way sinners are born again. The Lord speaks by the voice of the Son of God. When he speaks, he creates life in the dead sinner's heart. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made. That's true of the original creation. That's true of the new creation. And all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. Now, it doesn't say that he got a think tank together and got all of his buddies together and they all put their shoulder to the wheel, and that all of these demigods and the true God all worked together to finally exert energy to make the universe. I'm telling you, he just simply spoke it. He called galaxies and solar systems into existence and put it all in motion with exact, precise wisdom and in a delicate arrangement. And my friends, he sustains it, and he's been sustaining it since it was made. And it says, he gathereth the waters of the sea together as a heap. He layeth up the depth in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Here's the response. A God this great, a God this powerful, deserves to be worshipped, deserves to be respected and revered. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. I want to ask you, what do you stand in awe of this morning? You say, well, there are some things that are pretty awesome. I mean, I look at sunset. That's awesome to me. It is. It's beautiful. But see, the God who made the sunset is more glorious yet. Let us stand in awe of him. That's why divine worship on Sunday mornings and whenever we have opportunity to meet together is so important, because it reminds us of this powerful creator God. It reminds us of his majesty, his sovereignty. Listen to one more verse. Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 10. But the Lord is the true God. Now, in this context, he's talking about idolatry. Man has taken plates brought from Tarshish, gold from Uphaz, and the workman has worked with his hands. He's put it in the foundry, and he's fashioned, these cunning men have fashioned a god. And then he says, but, Jeremiah 10:10, the Lord is the true God. He is the living God. I like that. And an everlasting king. At his wrath the earth shall tremble, and the nations shall not be able to abide his indignation. Thus shall you say unto them, the Lord says to the prophet Jeremiah. Here's the message I want you to preach. The gods that have not made the heavens, that's everybody but the true God, right? The gods that have not made the heavens and the earth, even they shall perish from the earth and from under these heavens. For he hath made the earth by his power. Here it is, power. He made it by his power. He hath established the world by his wisdom, and hath stretched out the heavens by his discretion. His power, his wisdom, his discretion. He made the earth by his power. He established the world by his wisdom. He stretched out the heavens by his discretion. That means it was purposeful. It was deliberate. There was rhyme and reason behind it. He had a motive in doing things the way he did. When he uttereth his voice, it says there's a multitude of waters in the heavens. And he causeth the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He maketh lightnings with rain and bringeth forth the wind out of his treasures. This is the God of Genesis 1. Now, you're learning theology this morning. Are you a theologian? Everybody should be. You may not, and I may not, be a decorated official theologian, but every one of us, my friends, should have a knowledge of God. And it's the greatest study. The knowledge of God is greater than the knowledge of medicine, the knowledge of human anatomy, the knowledge of economics, the knowledge of literature, the knowledge of the classics, the knowledge of philosophical schools and genres. The knowledge of God theology is more important than psychology, physiology, sociology, paleontology, all of the ologies. Theology is the queen of the sciences. By the way, the idea of a university, have you ever picked words apart etymologically? The word university comes from two root words. Uni means what? Uni, one. Veritas, versity, veritas means truth. Do you know what a university was invented to be? A place that taught there is one truth. And theology was the queen of sciences, and all of the other disciplines were interpreted under the umbrella of the knowledge of God. I'll tell you, universities have abandoned, by leaving their foundation in believing that there's one unifying truth, and that is that God is and that He runs things. By leaving that and saying that you determine your truth and you determine yours, I'll tell you, universities should be called multi-heresies today. Not universe, not one truth, but many errors, right? I don't know of a university that really operates, maybe a Christian university, but most of them don't operate by that overarching concept anymore. So we learn that God is powerful. We also learn in Genesis that God is good. In the creation that He made, though He has great power, but you know, it's one thing to have power, but if you're not good with that power, then you've got problems. What is the old saying? Power corrupts. Have you heard that? And absolute power corrupts what? Absolutely. Okay, here's the one exception to that. Power did not corrupt God. He has all power. But with His power, He is the very source and embodiment of everything that is good. Notice the word good in verse 10 of Genesis chapter 1. God called the dry land earth. The gathering together of the waters He called seas, and God saw that it was G-O-O-D, good. You see it again in verse 18, and He gave the sun to rule the day, the moon to rule the night, and to divide the light from the darkness, and God saw that it was good. Now, when He says that God looked at His creation and says, it's good, it's not an aesthetic judgment. He's not just saying, well, that's pretty good. I'm proud of myself. He's not saying that in an aesthetic sense. What He's doing here is He's making a value judgment. What this means is that God, who made the world, has conferred moral value on the world that He has made. It is good in a moral sense. There's nothing sinful, nothing evil, nothing ungodly about the world that God made. Everything He does is good in a moral sense. Is that true? When God makes something, everything He makes is good in a moral sense. And this goodness of God, as we look at creation around us, is also evidenced or manifest in the many examples of His kindness and beneficence. We see it in the variety that is present in nature. Have you ever thought about how boring the world would be if there was one flower, every flower was a daffodil? I like daffodils, but I think I'd get tired of them if there was no variety. And if every daffodil was the same color, right? Have you ever thought about all of the different varieties, floral varieties? What about animal varieties? What if every dog looked alike? What if every animal was a canine or a dog, and every dog was the same size, shape, and color? What if the world was robotic and mechanical? What if every human being looked alike? You know, you look at pictures of aliens, which are just from the imagination of man's mind, but you look at pictures of aliens, and have you ever noticed how every one of them looks identical? Looks like cookie cutter, you know, just clones of one another. Human beings are not like that. I'm looking out over a congregation today, and I have to say, you're mighty good looking. And I hope you'll vote for me in the next election. But you're a fine-looking group of folks, but you look different. Every one of you has your own peculiar, unique features, but you're all human, right? There is amazing variety. And that makes the world very interesting. You know, that's one reason when it comes to some of those creatures in the book of Revelation that are described in heaven, having six wings, eyes before and behind and within, hands under their wings. You know, with two wings they cover their face, with two wings they fly. The seraphim, the cherubim, the creatures, the four beasts around the throne. Somebody says, what in the world is that? It wouldn't surprise me a bit if there are not creatures that we've never discovered in this present dimension that God has made that will bring fascination, intrigue, delight to the senses of God's people in heaven. It wouldn't surprise me a bit if those things are not literal. I wouldn't put it past the Lord to do that. Let us never think that we've figured him out and we've seen everything that he's made and have it all classified. No doubt there is more to what God has made than what you and I have ever seen or understood. And every time they explore another deep crevice in the ocean, they see creatures that they've never discovered before. Classification of the animals is an ongoing thing because they're always discovering new insects, new animals, new plant life that they've never seen before. They say that this is, I think it's similar to this. It's of this particular genus or kind, but I don't know exactly. I've never seen anything quite like this. God has immense, incredible variety. And my beloved, what he makes expresses his heart of beneficence, for he loves his people enough to fill nature with variety and to make bountiful provision for every part of it. Psalm 33 verse 5 is a wonderful verse. We were just in this chapter. He says, he loveth righteousness and judgment. The earth is full of the goodness of the Lord. One of my friends in Kentucky passed away a couple of years ago. And in some of the literature that was posted from her journals, one of the entries recorded these words, "Oh Lord, I am so amazed at your kindness as I think about my charmed life, which is so filled with thy goodness." Filled with your goodness. My friends, is your life filled with the goodness of God? His world is full of the goodness of the Lord. And every time I taste a Washington delicious apple, or a South Carolina Alberta peach, or every time I see a beautiful sunset, or hear the song of the nightingale or the robin, every time I feel the embrace of a loving wife, or hear the laughter of a little child, I think of how filled with God's goodness is the world that he has made. Isn't it wonderful, dear friends, that the God who's all-powerful is also eternally good and kind and merciful? Psalm 104, verse 24 says, O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. Now we come to our passage, and the clock has beaten me again today. I thought, okay, I'll just wrap up my comments from last week, which I just got started on. I'll just wrap it up neat and tidy in a little package today. And of course, I've just barely scratched the surface again. But this God that we learned about this morning also possesses the authority to govern. And here's where we come full circle to where we were last Sunday. This God who made it, because it's his football, then he makes the rules for the game. You ever heard the little boy say to his buddy, I'm going to take my ball and go home. You're not going to play by my rules? Well, here's the bottom line. The God who made the universe and is so good. In fact, even to Adam, you say, God's not good. And by the way, that's where the devil messed up. This passage in Genesis not only teaches us theology, it teaches us about demonology. It tells us there's a devil. And by the way, he's not eternal like God is. He was made upright, but he revolted and fell and was cast out into the earth. And we see him on the scene of human history as a serpent in Genesis 3:1. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field. And if you're going to have a biblical worldview, you've got to understand that there's an eternal God, but there's also an enemy who is against God and against you and against me in this world. He's a serpent. He's a sneaky snake. And this serpent said to Adam and Eve, if God really was good, he would let you have total freedom. You could eat any tree that you want. And the fact that God withheld something from you proves that he's not good. That was the devil's lie. God is keeping you from something that you want that would make you happy, make you wealthy and wise. And if God really was good, he would just let you live without borders, without boundaries, without restrictions. You could do as you please. You could be totally free. Here's the point. The God who's made it all also imposes some boundaries in which our freedom can be enjoyed. And you say, what right, what authority does he have to impose those boundaries? Well, he's the maker. He's the governor. And he commands Adam and Eve, and you see that in Genesis. He says, I want you to go dress the garden. So he gives them a task of managing the garden. He's commanded them to work. And then he imposes limits on what man can and cannot do. You may eat of every tree. Just the fact that he's withheld one tree teaches us that there are restrictions, there are moral limits that God has imposed, moral absolutes. That's where we come back full circle to where we were last time, and that's where we see in this passage that man has erred because he violated those restrictions, those boundaries. He trespassed. That's what a sin is, a trespass. You ever seen a sign, no trespassing means don't go beyond the barrier. Man trespassed. Forgive us our trespasses. That's what sin is. God's put the limit. Adam and Eve said, no, we're not going to do what God said. We're going to do what we want. We're going to crown ourselves as God. And they fell in sin. And that explains the problems we see around us. Have you ever heard somebody say, I just don't understand what's happening in the world? And the reason we don't understand it is because we don't have a biblical worldview. If you have this big picture framework, it will interpret what's happening in Washington, D.C., in Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, Los Angeles, California, New York City, New York, Atlanta, Georgia, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, right? It'll interpret everything around us, dear friends, if we understand that God made man in his image, but yet man revolted and that image has been marred and all death. Genesis 5 is the obituary chapter of the Bible. And he died and he died. All murder. Genesis 4, Cain slew Abel. All of this is a result, my friends, of sin's entrance into the world. You see how Genesis 1 through 11 explains the big picture. The biblical worldview to help us interpret everything else. These are the fundamentals. These are the ideas that make sense of the world, that explain the meaning of life, and give significance and purpose to human existence. If you chart your life today, my friend, by this biblical compass, it will guide your decisions. It will define your goals. It will motivate you toward the future. It will help you to interpret the events in the world around you. And it will give you assurance that in spite of the chaos around us, God is going to win in the end. And all will be well when Jesus comes again.